Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, retired chief of police and private investigator, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a member or a friend, and you'd like to send CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, then please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
Susan, Vito, good evening.
Good evening.
All right. Our first case tonight is that of the Joseph Damari case. Let me give you a little background. On the night of March 24, 1961, Francis Damari, hysterical and barefoot, stumbled into a gas station at 2350 Northeast 123rd Street in North Miami, Florida. About 150 yards away, in a vacant lot, the body of her husband, wealthy produce merchant Joseph Damari, was slumped in the driver's seat of his white 1961 Cadillac. He had been shot four times, including once through the mouth with a 25 caliber pistol. Francis told the police the couple had just left their Keystone Point home when two gunmen jumped into their car as they idled at the red light at North Bayshore Drive and Northeast 123rd Street. The attackers ordered the couple to drive to the vacant lot next to the broad causeway, where they were pistol-whipped. She said she passed out, and then when she came to, her 52-year-old husband was dead. No one has ever been charged with the murder. Over the five decades since the murder, the case has faded into obscurity except for one person. Richard Damari, Joseph's son, has been unwavering in his quest to get justice for his father, sometimes becoming an annoyance to local law enforcement. Joining us tonight is Richard Damari, who will give us an update on the status of the investigation. Richard, good evening.
Hi, how are you?
Well, would you give our listeners some background on, your dad. Before we get into the crime aspect, just tell us about your dad.
Okay, well, again, my father and his two brothers started the Damari family business. Again, we're from Boston. I see that you have an accent, too, so sounds like you might be from New England also.
I'm from Boston, yeah.
Okay, anyway, we were born in Belmont. My father and his two brothers started produce business in 1928. In 1941, that's when I was born. I was 6 months old. My father moved his family from Boston to Florida. So we grew up, we lived in Miami Beach, Florida. Our birth mother died in 1956 of breast cancer. And approximately 17 months later, my father met Frances. Apparently she was a bank teller. He met her. They married. Actually, Frances moved into our Miami Beach house in March of 58. That's when I first met her. They married July 3rd of 1958. So if you pin that out, they were only married for 32 months. My father's estate, fairly large at that time, a little bit over $1 million. And Frances, according to the will, she was entitled to half of it. When my father died, she was repeatedly wanting her money immediately. She finally settled for about $250,000. That is plus the house, et cetera, et cetera. The marriage was never good from the beginning. Frances, very demanding. She had a daughter. She wanted the daughter to live with us. And at the time, my father was raising four children as a single parent. So there was nothing but trouble. Frances had left a few times. Just to kind of make sure, now, on the night of the murder, Frances was driving the car, and my father was a passenger. He was shot actually two times, one in the lip and one in the mouth. Those are straight, you know, straight through shots. All of the shots had to have been almost at muzzle range, because when I viewed the body, there was no destruction of the head at all. Again, 25 caliber gun. My father had bought the gun, I don't know when, for protection, because he traveled 11 months out of the year. I was very suspicious. I kind of was rummaging around in the master bedroom one day, found this gun. It was fully loaded. I fired the gun into our pool and kept both the bullet and the expended shell. So when the murder took place, first thing I did was go to the bedroom. My father's gun was missing. I asked police. I was interviewed the next day, March 25th. I asked police where the gun was. They gave no indication. It took me about 20 years to find out that my father had been shot with his own gun. What's very interesting is that so there's a bullet in the mouth, a bullet in the upper lip, and they both lodged in the mouth. So obviously my father had to have been bleeding profusely. Two shots, one in the back of the ear, one into the temple. One of the bullets exited the head, and apparently when police found my father, his head had been resting against the passenger door. The bullet that exited broke some glass, so there's glass found in the right side of my father's head. Now, blood had dripped from within the vehicle and had been swept rearward by the forward motion of the vehicle. Now, what puzzles me is, my stepmother indicates that no shots were fired during the time that she was driving, and I find that impossible. In the 1991, 1992, I asked police if a blood spatter report had ever been completed. They indicated no. They brought in an expert named Ron Englert. He completed his report. Months had gone by. I asked the cold case detective what was going on. He said, oh, yeah, we got the report. I asked him for a copy, and they refused. But I did call this Ron Englert. He indicated that shots were fired from the driver's seat. Well, in my opinion, if you look at the body, I believe now, from the research I've done in the last 6 months or so, I believe that my stepmother fired the first two shots into the lip and mouth. Nothing has happened. I've repeatedly asked. There's two suspects. These suspects' names have come up over the years. Two brothers. One was my stepmother's hairdresser. The other one was his brother. His brother lived in Atlanta, just happened to be in the Miami area on the day of the murder. He also supposedly owned a 25 caliber gun. When I asked police for the serial number of that gun, they refused to give that to me.
Hold up. Vito, is that normal that and Tom that... that they would refuse to give a serial number to such an old case?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, that would be standard operating procedure, that they wouldn't release that type of information.
But nothing's going forward, so I guess it wouldn't hurt him, especially since he did what he did with the gun in the pool.
Well, you know, Susan, I try to... an old 1973 case of mine, murder case. The family wanted to rehire me because there was corruption on it back in the day, and I wasn't able to get even my own work back. You know, all I wanted was my own files, my own interviews, the numbers, different things of that nature. So, like Tom says, it's once a case is still out there, they're not going to give you anything. Am I right, Tom?
Yes, you are. Richard, so what are they doing right now? Is there an investigator assigned to this cold case?
Well, there is a cold case member. It's Detective Terry Goldston. In fact, I just spoke to him this morning, and what the problem I have is, unless I really produce evidence to them, they won't tell me anything. He did tell me today that my father's gun was never recovered, and it was never used in another crime. But if I can just continue in your introductory, my stepmother walked from the murder car, say, 100 yards, 150 yards to the gas station. And that whole area was totally undeveloped. It's coral rock. She walked to that gas station in her bare feet and had no bruises to her feet, which was very puzzling. A policewoman traced her exact route, came away with cuts and bruises to her feet. Her shoes were found in the open field. So how she was able to get from the car to the gas station without any bruises, totally puzzling. She also indicated she was pistol whipped. There's no evidence that she was ever pistol whipped. So, you know, the problem is she's the only one that's got the story.
All right, so if she didn't have any injuries to her feet, that would lead me to believe that she was dropped off, you know, before the shoes were thrown into the field. Would you agree with that, Vito?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, because I've been reading, this is one of the cases, Tom, that we were going to do several weeks ago, and there was computer problems, so I had read on the additional stuff. And, you know, her stumbling to the gas station, you know, all this kind of stuff, and then no cuts or bruises or anything on her feet. And so, Frances's face had scratches that looks as though she made them herself by running her hands down her face. So there's a lot of different things going on. Trouble is, like you know, Tom, this is such an era back then in the early 1960s, you know, as far as police work, you know.
Yeah, a lot to be desired.
It's an intimate partner homicide. And you know, I find this mind-blowing that the stepmother marries the attorney
8 months later. And
you know,
again,
to
give you an example, unless I produce, after the Miami Herald did a major article on the 25th of March, the Herald reporter told me to go to the Palm Beach County court docs, which I did, and I found out that the attorney knew my stepmother while married to my father. Well, the police, you know, I've asked them for 10 years, the attorney's
name. Is the attorney still alive, Richard?
No, he died in 05, William K. Chester. So I asked police 10 years ago if he and Frances knew each other. They never answer. So unless I can produce evidence, they won't answer my questions.
How old were you, Richard?
The family, my oldest brother was 23. The middle brother was 22, I was 19, and we have a sister who was 8. But let me also just give you some very puzzling things. On the day of the murder, my brother James was in the family business. They were supposed to go from, we had a house there in North Miami at the time, supposed to go to Fort Pierce, about a 2.5-hour trip. My father calls my brother at 9 o'clock, cancels the appointment, says, don't come to the house. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, my brother and I were both students at U of M. My brother was a medical student. My father calls us at 4 o'clock and says, don't come home for the weekend. Well, my father never called us, never alerted us to, you know, something was wrong at the house. I sensed something was wrong, and my brother Joseph had the phone. I asked my father. I took the phone. I asked my father if everything was okay, and the line went dead. My opinion is these two perps, and they've already been identified by two cold case members. These perps were already in the house. My father is shot on the way. In other words, by the time they, you know, these two people supposedly entered at the light, my father's dead.
Mm-hmm.
He's already been shot, and that's how blood.
Were you
ran
living?
Down.
Were you Richard? Were you living in the home at the time, or were you away at college, or out of the house?
I was out of the house at college. I went to the University of Miami an hour away.
Besides,
so we had three
DeMari
children living at home. In
okay.
fact, so the three boys were told not to come to the house. We could not find my sister when we came back to the house. In other words, we were told my father was in an accident. When we came back to the house, we had to go look for my sister. So
where was she?
You know, Well, she was, again, eight years old. She was wandering in the neighborhood.
In the neighborhood. Vito, does that make sense? Why is she wandering in the neighborhood? Something?
You know, this whole thing doesn't make sense. I don't know if you touched on it already, but Richard, the stuff I am reading here, some of the notes said that your father planned to divorce your stepmother, and then after the murder, you went to the home and were told by your stepmom, you have 24 hours to get everything else out of the house. This is my house now. Is that all that true?
Oh, yes. We were blocked.
She got $1 million in cash at that point?
No, well, what happened was the will, my father's estate was $1.2 million. She was entitled to half the house, cars, et cetera, et cetera. What's very interesting, in my father's will, there was a codicil that said if she was not living in the house, if any violence happened to him, she could not participate in any of the estate. So, in my opinion, she knew what that will said. And, again, my father was planning to divorce her. He goes to Boston Sunday, March 19th, for 4 days to talk to his brother about getting a divorce. He comes home on Thursday, and he's dead the next day. I mean, nothing fits.
Well, actually, a lot fits, but nothing fits as far as the events that investigators didn't seem to put it together in a different way.
Right.
And yeah. did somebody immediately go with what was said in that will to investigators? Because that clause is very important, I would think.
It is very important. Like I said, I've spent 30 years, unless I can come up with some evidence, and that's basically, they tell me thank you, but, that doesn't get us. I mean,
your sister was 8 years old. Does she remember? How was she after all this? Do you have a good relationship with her?
I have a really good relationship. In fact,
does she remember?
The Miami Herald article, my sister wrote a little blog there that Frances had beaten her a few times, and she remembers, welts on her back. So that was not very pleasant for her.
Does she remember the events, or was she ever interviewed? And she probably wouldn't be in that time frame because she was a child. Her only legal guardian is your father, and he's dead, right?
Well, the legal guardian became my oldest brother. My sister did go live with
him. I'm saying at the time of but immediately, so that you don't have the mother, the stepmother there. Everybody's gone. Does she remember conversation that may have taken place between the stepmother and your dad about anything that didn't make sense? She was a violent lady towards her. No?
Yeah, no, I'm the only one that, basically I would normally go home every weekend, so I saw what was going on in the house. Thank God that I found the gun, fired it. What's puzzling to me is, how does my father's gun get in the hands of the shooter? My father's in the front, shooters are in the back. How does he get shot? How does someone turn a gun and point it directly at his head? Doesn't. He's shot from the driver's seat. The first two shots, one bullet lodged in the lip. If you saw the pictures, you'd immediately say nobody could shot him from the back on those two.
Tom Shamshak, in a case like this, as a former chief of police, when it basically gets passed down then, and you would have, to know that this case was there in the files in the department, what can be done, if anything, for a case like this that a family can do in this kind of a situation? It's an old case.
Well, there are a few things that can be done. One, to do what Richard's doing now by keeping it in the public eye, trying to get somebody to do a televised reconstruction, some video. Have you reached out to media to have this aired, Richard?
Well, again, to bring you up to date, the Miami Herald did a front-page article March 25th. What's interesting is the two prime suspects have already been identified. The lead investigator in 1981, when I spoke to him, placed the hairdresser in my father's car and said that the hairdresser shot my father. but I could never get lead investigator to, you know, fill me in. That's number one. Cold case detective in like 91, 92 said, yeah, these two brothers, the Irwin brothers, are in your father's car. They fired shots, but there were more factors to the case. So that's where it ended. So these
how long was your mother-in-law or your stepmother married to this lawyer, for a long time?
No, they were married, as I said, my father was married 32 months, 3 weeks. The attorney, Chester, they married 8 months later. They were married for less than 3 years. And what's also interesting is Francis remarried after that. The name is Schick. And all the information I find is Chester. In fact, there's no death certificate that I could find. So I
what type of law did Chester practice?
He was a district attorney at one time. Oh, but well, it's really interesting, and it took me a week to do this. The Miami Herald reporter put me onto the Palm Beach County court docs. There's probably 20 to 30 entries with Francis and Chester doing real estate deals. So, in my opinion, I think my father was set up by both of them to get seed money so that they could be lovers and carry on the way they wanted.
Vito, you have a lot of experience with these kind of cases, Vito.
My question,
does that make more sense?
Richard, did you ever find out if they still, in the police station, still have the box or boxes of everything from the crime scene? You know, your dad's clothes, anything that they take. Do you know at all if that stuff is still there?
I assume it's still there. I've asked if all the blood in the car was my father's, and they said yes. I have asked if there's any blood spatter on Francis' dress, and they won't answer that.
Because you know, I asked that question because, you know, now 50 years later with DNA, it'd be kind of interesting to see what they have in that box. And if they have a cold case detective that is willing to at least take the time, a matter of maybe 1 month, to even do a little investigation. Now, I know as an ex-cop and Tom himself, too, as a former chief of police, they're going to be very hesitant because they're thinking to themselves, okay, well, wait a minute. Anybody that was remotely connected in this, they're all dead. It's 50 years ago. What do you want us to do? Now, I'm not saying that's the right logic, but that's their logic. Now, it's still, though, as a family member, I'd love to know what was in that box, or even if they don't tell you because they can't, can you please see if there's any DNA off of anything? Reopen the box if you haven't had the box opened, Mr. Detective, for 20 years.
I have a suggestion. Why don't you, Richard, write to the cold case unit, Cheryl McCollum, and see if they'll take this case? Because you know it so intimately, you know every single detail, there might be an opportunity for them to take it, and then you would find out perhaps what's in that box, and you would find out more information and more details that weren't revealed to you. Tom, does that make sense?
It does, absolutely.
So I can give you, Richard, sometime later tonight, I can get you the email address where you would, I'll tell you how to write the letter, or by morning, I'll tell you how to write the letter, what it should say, and spell it out, and you're asking for the cold case unit in Atlanta, Georgia, to please consider looking at it. I mean, if they can go and look at Jesse James' bullets and go and find out the Ford killers and do such great work that way, this might be something where you would get further with an answer for you and your family.
Okay, and just to give credit to Miami-Dade Police, there's some new technology on examining case shells for fingerprints, and when I mentioned that to the detective, they indicated they had done that, couldn't find any prints or whatever, and they also did the super glue, you know, whatever that would bring up, I don't know. So
it would identify fingerprints if they were on the casing. Richard, have you considered hiring a private investigator to assist you?
Oh, I did that many years ago. I had a lead on the hairdresser's wife, but it turned out to be a dead end.
I think Richard should become a PI. He's very good.
The other, just to kind of also help you out, the Miami Herald, the writer was David O'Valley, and he asked me, he said, well, gee, maybe the next step would be the Herald filing a Freedom of Information lawsuit. I said, yeah, why don't you guys do that? I've asked you for, you know, 30 years to kind of do something more. But let me just, again, quickly, the two prime suspects, in fact, in 2001, do you all remember when Dale Earnhardt died?
Yep.
Okay. Well, when he died, you know, his wife, Teresa, got the Florida legislature to pass a bill preventing the disclosure of the autopsy report. I wrote a letter to the state senator, Posey, and, you know, it took me 10 years to get the autopsy report. I didn't get it through police. I got it through the medical examiner in the back door. Anyway, Posey's now in the Congress, and his assistant called Miami-Dade Police in 2001, and police said, yes, the two prime suspects are these brothers, Lewis Irwin and the hairdresser. In fact, the hairdresser, it was rumored that he and Francis were having an affair. So, you know, I mean, these names
are they alive?
Come up. No, the hairdresser had a heart attack 3 years later after the murder. Good riddance. But again, these names, you know, the hairdresser's name came up immediately. In fact, an anonymous call came in, and they were going to link the hairdresser to the murder, but the person never showed up. So, you know, I don't know these two brothers from Adam. These names have been given to me for 30 years. So, anyway. All right, well, I'll just stay on. You want to give me that cold case Atlanta thing?
I will get a hold of you sometime either after the show or in the morning, and I will get it to you, and I will get you the proper channels to do that. You know, you're also very fortunate that you have a sunshine law there, that you're able to get access to a lot of things that in other states that they don't have, and that your persistence has really gotten you to this point.
Well, let me tell you what it doesn't get me. Florida has a law that any murders before 1979, police do not have to, open up their files. I have a legal ruling from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement that if I ever, you know, had the money and was going to file a suit, I would have prime standing in a court of law.
You mean the FDLE is saying that to you?
Yes.
Okay. And you know, maybe Tom, maybe there's something here a little bit further that, I mean, that's a very interesting type of suit.
Well, it is.
That could be.
It set a precedent. Other cases would have to be opened up as well.
Maybe there's a way for us to dig around. Maybe, Tom, you know some folks that would be able to, you know, look into this. Maybe it's, you know what? It's the college, it's the university down there, Richard. Why don't you also try to contact some professors at the university there? And, you know, a lot of times, too, as a project, students that are in law school, fourth year, that are ready to go practice, what they do is they make them, you know, look into cases like this. This would be precedent setting, and it would be a university project that would probably work out, and the university professors all teach. They're lawyers.
Oh yeah, isn't there something at Northwestern that they look at old cases as a school project?
You're talking about David Provost. No, that's different. That's different. That's for convicted people that are in jail.
Oh, okay.
I'm saying that the university there in Florida, because of the law, a professor who teaches law is also a lawyer. So
right.
They would be able to, if you pitched it correctly, you know, presented it correctly, they would be able to most likely consider taking it because it sets precedent and they would get credit for it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And we know somebody that's at Miami University who's a forensic pathologist. One of our consultants has just indicated that in our interactive chat room. So we could help you follow up with it, Richard.
Okay.
See,
so let's
look
stay
at all
in touch.
You get. Outside the box.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And just to make sure, if anybody would ever contact Miami-Dade Police, the cold case member is Detective Terry Goldston, G-O-L-D-S-T-O-N. And
also Richard, do you have a website for this?
No.
A blog, a website? This is very important. Why don't you, are you computer literate? Yes?
Not really, but if you type in the Joseph Damari murder,
That's not good enough. Do you have some family member, some grandson, somebody that could just put up a page for you?
Well, there is a page on, I belong to that unsolved crimes thing.
No, with your dad's name in it, it should be www.justice4 with his name.com that you do. Is it possible?
I could get somebody to do that.
Okay. It's very simple. You can even do it on a blog. You know, you can go to Google and put it together. It's important because with the progress and the information as you're doing this, as it gains momentum, let's say the cold case unit takes it, or let's say, you're able to get a lawyer to take this case, it crawls. People will look at it. People will go to that page often. They will get to know the case, and that's what you want.
Right. Okay.
Okay. All right.
Points well taken. Good, thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Richard. All right,
we don't have anybody here, so I think that we should talk about whatever is topical that's going on at this moment, because the next guest hasn't called in yet to the board.
Well, obviously that would be the Casey Anthony case, am I correct?
Oh, here it is. Got it.
Oh, here they are?
Yes.
People are there?
Yes.
Both of them?
No, one. We can talk about the Kaylee Anthony case for a second.
Okay. All right, your observations then, Susan. What do you think?
Oh, please. I think it's a waste of taxpayer dollars to even go there. I mean, this whole case to me is that a child's voice has been silenced forever, and that is a crime that's just irreparable. I think Tom would have...
Yeah, I mean, you watch this case, and you know, all of us have been involved in these type of big cases. And as I put it on, you hate to say something. I mean, I think the prosecution is trying to do a meticulous job of trying to put everything out there. I just wish that some of the attorneys would have a little more. If I'm a juror, I'd like to have a little more oomph in some of their voices. Not that they have to yell or do things of that nature, because they all have their own style. But it's kind of like, you know, dragging along, especially with Baez. You know, I mean, he says things that really, I've been in front of a lot of top attorneys, and I don't know. I don't know his logic or what he's trying to go ahead on this, but he's not doing a heck of a good job. Things that he said in his opening arguments is going to bounce back on him, and I think near the end. But it is what it is. Everybody has their own style, and they're the attorneys, and we're not. So,
what are they doing, though? I mean, Tom, when you see a case like this, I know it makes your blood boil.
Yeah, it does. The mounting behavioral evidence, the lying, the forensics, I think it's, you know, it's water torture here. And I think the government has, you know, made its case. It'd be interesting to see how defense lays out its case. Has our guest come on board
yes,
yet?
Yes, sir. Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, we have them both there?
Yes, we do.
Okay, I'll read the description here. On January 16th, 1987, 17-year-old Joseph Helt of Ellenville, New York, was with friends at the old Mount Kapalea Ski Lodge in Cragsmore, New York, a popular local party spot. At approximately 3:30 a.m., Joe left in a car with three acquaintances, Kelly Diaz, Wade Marks, and John J.P. LaForge. According to these three, their car got stuck in a ditch on Sam's Point Road. Joe got frustrated and left to walk back to Ellenville. Kelly and Wade left about 20 minutes later, walking the same way Joe did. And John left 10 minutes after that and walked the short distance back to his home in Cragsmore. Kelly, Wade, and John all made it home safely, but Joe was never seen again. Joining us tonight are Joseph's aunt, Beth Churchill, and family friend, Gina Schuster. Welcome, ladies, to the show.
Thank you. Is Gina there?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Is Gina
is
there?
Gina with Gina?
Yes, they're both here.
Okay, because I wasn't sure Gina was going to be able to make it.
Yes.
Well, why don't we start, Beth, either you or Gina. Tell us, tell the listeners across the country a little background on your nephew, Joseph, what kind of kid he was and different things about him, whatever you remember.
Well, what I remember about Joe, there was 4 years between us. He's 4 years younger than I was at the time. And he was a typical teenager in the 80s. He, you know, listened to his music. He loved to listen to his, you know, rock music all the time. He was very friendly, very outgoing. He was a good kid, he did what a lot of kids did back then. And, you know, there's not much to do in this little town that we live in. So they like to gather and, go to their party spots
Well, Beth, the first thing that jumps out to me as a former cop and reading the story here, supposedly the car got stuck in a ditch, okay, with all four of them in there. Did you ever find out 24 years later if that was actually true? Was that car taken out of there by a tow truck? Did the police show up at the scene and see that car? Go ahead.
I don't know. The car was not there when the police were notified. The car was, according to the investigator, the car was towed the following morning.
Okay.
On Saturday. So, I mean,
okay.
I don't know if there are records of it or a friend towed his car or, you know, I don't know what proof they have. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of information from the investigation at the time either.
Was this a deserted type of an area? Why were they heading? Was this the common way back home or something?
No. It's definitely not the way back home. It's up on a mountain.
This
time of year, there's really nothing going on up there. It's further up the mountain from where the original party spot was. So why they went there, you know, is a mystery. I don't know why.
Are the people that he's with, are they older or are they his age, 17?
The two of them were around the same age as Joe. The driver of the car, which was John, was older. Kelly was maybe a little younger than Joe at the time.
Hey, Susan, the thing that jumps out at me, Susan, here in the description here, it says Kelly and Wade left about 20 minutes later walking the same way Joe did. So now my first question is, okay, is there any lights in this area? Is there any lights at all?
No.
Or are they pitch dark here? No lights. Okay. Now,
the only light there would be, you know, if the moon was out.
Right.
In other words,
they're saying he left. They went in the same direction he did. How would they know that? They could only see about maybe 5 feet in front of them.
Yeah.
So
that's
a little bit suspicious to me. Okay. The same path he went. That's not true at all because you're in pitch dark over there. So,
right.
You know.
Yeah,
I mean,
there definitely are no lights.
What is jumping out at you on this initial stuff here, Tom?
Well, interestingly, the very first question that I had was there confirmation that the automobile was actually in a ditch, and was a tow truck ever dispatched? And again, Beth, if the police had responded or if the tow truck went there because it was a police you know, there was a roadway hazard, there would be in the daily log, even way back then, there'd be an entry that the vehicle was taken to perhaps, you know, the impound lot, or it was taken to, you know, somebody's garage. Now, have the people that were there at the party, beyond these three people that we've just been talking about, have they been identified and have they been interviewed?
I believe, you know, back then the police did go to the high school and talk to some kids. I don't know how many of them. I honestly only know a couple that were there that night. And, you know, there was probably a good amount of kids up there. But I don't know. And as far as the tow truck goes, I'm not sure. It may have been, from what I understand, it was a friend of his that came and towed it out for him.
Uh-huh.
Why don't we do this? You know, Ron Hahn is working this case. He's a retired detective. Welcome to the show, sir. Maybe you can shed some additional light on this case.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are
Bob,
you?
Good evening.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good evening.
All right, my friend.
We've done work on the case, and we've interviewed approximately half a dozen people, and from the information that we got from the people that A, did speak to us, and B, were telling us the truth, we believe that the whole scenario of the car being stuck on a mountain and Joe walking away, we believe that that was fabricated and didn't happen at all.
Hmm.
And it's leading us or has led us into another direction completely. Unfortunately, a lot of the people that we spoke to have not been forthcoming and telling us all of the information. For some reason, they seem to be afraid, or they're holding back for some reason.
Yes.
And I don't know why. And
is there,
you know,
a tip line or a reward offered in this at all?
Not at this time, no.
Hey, Robert, Vito Colucci here. How you doing, sir? These other three individuals who would be about 40 or 40-something now, have they been spoken to lately, in the last couple of years, sir?
Not to my knowledge. We sat down with the investigator from the New York State Police that has the case now, and we told him that we were, you know, working for the family, and we wanted to you know, work alongside of him, and we weren't going to impede his investigation. And he had asked that we not speak to them, that they would be doing that. So I have not spoken to them, and I don't know when the last time the police have spoken to them.
Okay, what about, why has this case ever been registered with Q Center or a missing persons organization?
When I got involved with Beth and Gina, I suggested a couple of different missing person sites that they, you know, should register him with. One of them being NAMIS, and I think Beth and Gina took care of all of that.
Not a missing persons organization, and Q Center is a consultant for us here on the show, and to get that information out, they'd put an extra website out. They would do things, you know, to get some information and just generate, because to me, they're one of the larger organizations that go out there and really work to locate the missing person and work with the family.
Okay,
we can hook you up with them.
Okay, that would be good. Is Beth on? Is Beth
there? I'm here. Yeah.
Hi, yes. Beth. I don't know what other sites that you you listed, you know, the information about Joe with.
Actually, I wish Gina was able to be here. She's not feeling well tonight. She actually has done most of that. I mean, I know he's on, you know, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
Okay.
Daddy is on. He was actually just put on there by the New York State Police, like, in November. So all these years he hasn't been on there.
Hey, Beth, are you the closest family member to Joseph?
He has siblings. He has two older sisters and a younger brother. Oh, and he has another younger sister that actually he never met, but he does have siblings that are still around.
Because I understand what Rob just said, that you know, the police have asked him, you know, do not go and interview or try to, you know, do anything mm-hmm. with the three other people. But I think a family member could call the detective who's actively working on the case, just as simply said, have any of you guys interviewed any of these three recently?
I am in contact with the investigator, and one of them no longer lives in New York State. He lives out of state. I don't know if they've been in touch with him, but from what I understand, they have touched base with the other two.
Okay, because I'm a firm believer in the least culpable person, maybe 25 years, 24 years later, wanting to shed some light on the incident. But,
right.
You know, again, have to see how this all plays out.
Mm-hmm. And Bob, when you took this case, did you see that, was there something with, you know, Kelly was the only girl there, correct?
Oh, Kelly is a boy.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
Sorry, he's a man now.
Okay. Because I saw here, for example, one woman came forward stating that she witnessed a conversation that Kelly Diaz had with her ex-husband, where Kelly stated that the story about the car getting stuck in the ditch was just a cover story. So that's why I got confused.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So you have all guys, and how long did they know each other for?
Were
they friends a long time?
Well, I at that point in time, I didn't really know Joe's closest friends. I'm sure they knew each other from being in school together, and they hung out at the same place. I don't know how close they all were, but, you know, they did know each other. I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't just leave with them if he wasn't, you know, if he didn't know them. I don't know as far as how close they were, what kind of friends they were, or if they were friends at all. I don't know that they were.
Bob, were you able to determine the relationship between he and these kids, these other kids that were there?
No, because we weren't allowed to speak with them, and the people that we did speak to didn't know how far back the relationship went. So, no, I was not able to determine that.
What about yearbooks and things of these kids? You know, you can go to classmates.com or reunion.com, maybe. Is it possible to look them up to see, to get other information that way? Does that make sense?
Yeah, we can look them up. Again, if Gina has more history with the three individuals and Joe from when they went to Ellenville High School.
Okay.
So again, if she was on, you know, she'd be able to shed some light on that. But she is aware of the history that they had at, you know, in the high school together.
Bob, what kind of search occurred after the young man was reported missing?
From what I understand, they did it was snowing heavily that night, so they mm-hmm. they waited until the snow ended, and they did a brief search. From what I understand, they did have canines out. They searched the area, the mountain area. I don't know how extensive it was. And they, from what I understand, and Beth can correct me if I'm wrong, but they are planning on doing another search of the area for remains, or at least that's the last I heard from the state police. Have they given you a time, Beth, when they're going to do that?
No, not really. They really are hesitant about sharing any information, maybe because of they're afraid that something might get out. You know, I don't know, but I'm not able to get much information out of them at all. You know, they did share with me that they were going to be searching, but I don't know when, I don't know what area, I don't know much at all. I don't know anything about the investigations, you know, that happened 24 years ago. I don't, you know, all I know is that was in the newspapers because they won't allow me to see the reports.
Beth, let me ask you this. That area around Sam's Point Road, how mm-hmm. big of an area are we talking about? Is this a lot of woods? Are these acres? Are these high mountaintops where somebody could have fell off and died that way? I mean, give us some kind of description of what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, I don't know how to explain it. It's on a mountain, but it's not like, you know, big hilly mountain with woods and everything. There's trails all over the place. It's a heavily hiked area. I mean, it's a very popular hiking spot. So there are trails all over the place. There are crevices, rocks with crevices. And, you know, in 24 years, with all the people hiking through there and hunting and everything, nothing has been found there. Mm. So, you know,
it doesn't also help too. Signs have been torn down, flyers, the things that you did. And Vito, I was going to ask you, I mean, the father of one of the kids was a judge in town. He had a lot of influence, a lot of money.
Mm.
That would hinder something like this. That's important. And the fact that, you know, we've had a lot of shows, cases like this on the show. When stuff starts getting torn down, posters for information, what is it that somebody wants to keep away from this? And I think that Vito and Tom and Bob, that this is important when you've got somebody so heavily influential in that town that they're not going to do certain things that they would normally do in an investigation. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, who would tear down a poster? You know, and that really makes you think, Susan, because, you know, this is somebody's loved one. There's posters that go up. Even if people don't want to get involved, they ignore the poster. But it takes a certain type of individual, for whatever reason, to go around and tear down these posters. Rob, let me just ask you one question. Do you know by any chance if back then the police did any grid searches of this area at all or no?
Again, they would not allow me to look at any of the reports that were prepared back then. So the only information I have about the searches that were done was what I read in the old newspaper articles, and I do not think a grid search was done back then.
Okay, is the judge still alive? The father of one of the boys that was with him.
I don't know. You know what? I'm not even sure. I wasn't even aware that the father was a judge. This is something that someone recently told me. If he is alive, he's not involved in anything in the village anymore.
But back then they would make sure that things weren't. I find it odd. Tom, weigh in on this. Why won't they let Tom have a look at the reports? It's kind of courtesy, isn't it?
To let who look at the reports? That says to me that they're hesitant because they probably are working something. And I can tell you, Beth, one of the reasons they won't divulge, you know, where and when, they'd be fearful that somebody might go and tamper with physical evidence that may be out there.
Right, and that I understand. I absolutely understand that, and I wouldn't want that to happen.
Or go after one of the individuals that they feel committed this crime. So my point is that
23 years later, it's frustrating to me. Because, you know, in all of us working with these families like we do all the time, to do that, and you would think that, I don't think half the time it is about that always. I think that, you know, all these years have passed.
Bob, you've worked. You're working other unsolved cases on a pro bono basis. What's your experience?
I think, Tom, in this one, because of the political connections and because it's a small, tight-knit community,
Bingo.
I think that that has a lot to do with the fact that people aren't talking to us or aren't cooperating with us. You know, that says a lot. I think they're just afraid, you know?
They're intimidated.
They are. I think they are. The other cases that, you know, that I'm working on, you know, we track down the individuals that were with the person when he disappeared. We tracked them down. We spoke to them. Everybody, you know, was very cooperative in the other case we were working on. But this one, everywhere we go, we're hitting a dead end. People just don't want to talk to us. And if they do talk to us, they're not
political.
They're not,
you know.
They're not telling us the truth if they do talk to us. So we're chasing, you know, we're chasing lies. They're telling us one story, and then we have to go, you know, verify whether or not it's the truth. And it's, you know, we're running around in circles.
You know, Tom,
that's frustrating.
If there is corruption going on in this case because of the father, okay, it's going to be very difficult because the police department has already said to a private detective, do not go and interview people, okay? You know, the cases I work, I always say all the time, I work parallel with the police. The police most of the time welcome that because the day I get information, they get that same information from me. No one's going out and being a glory hunter and trying to solve the case. To be told that you can't even hire, well, you can hire a private detective, but you can't have them do the most important things 25 years later, you know, and I guess they could hold over somebody's head, Tom, that, you know, okay, hey, we'll come and arrest you because you're tampering with our investigation, which would be ridiculous. This guy's a noted former New York City detective. You would think they would want that help. So it rings a lot of things to me, Tom. You know what I'm saying?
No, I hear you. I hear you clearly. That's a huge red flag.
Yeah.
You know, Vito, I told them exactly what you just said, that, you know, we're not looking to interfere. We're not looking to steal your thunder. We want to work along, you know, we want to, like, work parallel with you. Any information
right.
we obtain, I will call you immediately. And, you know, he was receptive to that. The investigator was receptive to that. But at the same time, he told me because it was an ongoing investigation, I wasn't entitled or I could not see any of the paperwork.
Well, I can understand not seeing the paperwork, but you mean 10 years from now, if the family rehires you, that you still can't go visit these people? That rings no sense to me. I mean, you know, because, you know, those people maybe are married, they got their own children now. Maybe you get one of them that wants to clear the air after all these years. Not because they're involved, but they do know something. They may live in another town, another state, where they don't have to worry about this judge or whoever anymore, you know? So I just hope that the police are interviewing these people. That's my whole point.
Well, the investigator said that, you know, we can speak to anyone involved in a case except those three. And that's the way it was left.
I have some ideas. I can be reached at murphymilano@gmail.com, and maybe I can come up with a couple things that might help you get this case moved forward.
Okay,
and,
that'd be great.
You know, at least, get a hold of me and email me, and just we can go from there, because we have had a lot of success with, haven't we, Vito and Tom?
Yes.
With movement and getting things and at least getting some movement in the case. I don't think that they really want me to get involved, but this is making me upset. So if you get a hold of me, I just see some things that are possibilities to possibly get people to do some things for you. And most of all, you know, for Joseph, he hasn't been found. You know, it's wrong. It's a tragedy in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. You're absolutely right.
Susan, I think you should have Beth and Bob on your own radio show for guest appearance.
Well, I was thinking of some other, you know, I prepare cases in a different way and do things in a different way. So I would need to put together some stuff that I think a little bit of a different kind of a plan out for this now that we've heard this and see what we can do. But we are out of time. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, and our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, June 21st, 2011. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes, interrupt, and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Tom Shanchak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Good night.
Good night.